If you attended church this week, you no doubt sang. If you're running a youth group, you most likely get your students singing. And maybe your time at home or in the car is spent listening to what is called worship music. In recent years, there have been mounting debates about what music is the best worship music. Are the new songs too shallow? Are the old hymns irrelevant and out of date? Does music teach us and form us as followers of Christ? Stay tuned for a thought-provoking conversation about the power of music, along with an introduction to a new way of thinking about worship and spiritual formation with musician Kevin Twitt from Indelible Grace on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, the music issue has been a big one in the church for quite some time, you know, with the advent of the shift from many churches doing the old hymns and moving more to what's been called contemporary worship songs. There's been a lot of back and forth about, you know, what's the best way to go? Are we singing human-centered songs? Are we singing God-centered songs? What does that all mean? And I know that's been a discussion in our world of youth ministry, and that's what we want to address today. And you know, I've been battling that out in my own mind, and I love music, and I love to sing, and I see the value of it in worship. And trying to think about it theologically, one of the great helps for me has been the discovery of the Indelible Grace movement, which is a group of artists we'll hear more about in just a little bit, who have been taking some of the old hymns and recording them to some newer tunes in ways that really bring them to life. And we're going to talk about that today, and before we jump in with Kevin Twitt from Indelible Grace, I want to welcome in a couple of my friends from RYM, Reformed Youth Ministries, John Parrott, who is the Director of Resources for RYM, and then Joe Deegan, who actually, Joe, you're worship leading down in Houston at a church now, correct?
I am. I attend Christ the King Presbyterian, and I help lead there on Sundays.
Okay. Football season started. How are the Oilers doing? Oh, that's right. They're not, playing anymore.
Actually, they did pretty well yesterday.
Yeah, it's the Texans
beat
now.
The Browns,
yeah.
Technically.
Yeah, that's right. They beat the Browns.
The Titans,
good,
yeah.
That was a test to see if you knew that. So
hey,
that's good.
There you go.
Tennessee, right. They're actually up in Nashville where Kevin is now.
Yeah.
But Joe's the director of music resources, or the music resources coordinator for RYM as well. And I brought these guys in because they've thought about these things. They've had to plan worship for students and for youth workers. And they're going to participate in this discussion with Kevin. And so, Kevin Twitt, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, Kevin, tell us a little bit about the Indelible Grace movement, how you got started in it, your role with it, and what you guys are doing.
Yeah. So, I've been working in the music business since the late 80s. Went to a place called Berklee College of Music in Boston. Moved down to Nashville, and eventually, I started teaching a college Sunday school class at Christ Community Church down in Franklin, where Scotty Smith was the pastor. And I had a bunch of students, and they began telling me about this thing called RUF that had come to Vanderbilt. So that was my first exposure. Now, what I came to eventually
RUF,
go to one
RUF,
of those meetings.
Yeah, what's RUF? So, because some folks aren't familiar with RUF.
Oh, sorry, RUF, right. Reformed University Fellowship, which is the campus ministry of the Presbyterian Church of America, the PCA. So I was just a volunteer. I was playing in a rock band at that point and teaching the Sunday school class for college students. And actually, I remember quoting a little passage from J.C. Ryle's book, Holiness. And one of the students said, my RUF minister told me I should read that book. And I was like, really? What is RUF? I got to hear about some ministry that likes good books like that. So I went up there, and I remember going to that first meeting, and they were singing hymns. They were doing a few to new tunes already, and then trying to sing more Bible songs, scripture songs. And then the guy, Hal Farnsworth, preached a full-on sermon. And I've been involved in various campus ministries in Boston, different ones at different schools, and I'd never seen a campus ministry that didn't water things down. And I was really intrigued by that. So what I always like to tell people is Indelible Grace, kind of, it didn't start this thing, really. It was going on in RUF and in RYM. Actually, from my understanding, Darwin Jordan had really kind of started doing this stuff with students through RYM, spreads to RUF. And then when I graduated seminary from Covenant Seminary in 95 and got back to Nashville, started RUF at Belmont University, I just became increasingly concerned that a lot of the songs we were singing were lying to my students about what the normal Christian life felt like. And I was like, we got to find some better songs to sing. Now, we were already had a few of these songs that were starting to develop in the RUF and RYM world. But I think my background in the music business, plus my my students at Belmont, I had so many really talented students like Sandra McCracken and Matthew Smith and Katie Bowser. All these people were, you know, Belmont is like half music or music business majors. And so I think we just started working on this music kind of in our little countercultural Sunday school class. The church service itself was not doing this kind of music. They thought it didn't really appeal to the broader demographic they wanted to reach. But we were really finding this music very formative and important to us. And then eventually we made a CD because the Auburn RUF group made a CD. And I was like, you know, that was okay, but we've got some really talented people. I've been a recording engineer and I've got good contacts. So maybe we'll make a little record. Put 17 songs on that first record. Didn't think we'd ever make another one. And lo and behold, like people really resonated with it. And that's kind of, I guess the rest is history.
Yeah. So what you did really goes against sort of the accepted conventional wisdom, and I use the word wisdom loosely there, where people just, I find that youth workers especially just assume that this stuff is old, it's irrelevant, it's not going to connect with anybody, it's not the least bit helpful, and what we try to do is we work very hard to, I think we sacrifice depth on the altar of what we believe to be relevant, but that wasn't your experience. You're finding the students...
Right.
You expose them to it, and they connect. Talk a little bit about that. Well, I'd like to hear from John and Joe, too, on that after you answer, Kevin.
I mean, the way I like to talk about that is I remember seeing a sign in an antique store one time that said, my grandmother saved it, my mother threw it away, and now I'm buying it back. I do think we are at the front edge of something. You know, David Brooks wrote about it in his book, Bobos in Paradise, which came out around the time. Like, there was definitely a sense that, you know, is there something more solid, something that has longer roots. I think Gerard Kelly, that book Retro Future, he was like an English worship leader. I really like that book. He talked about the importance of roots and wings. So I feel like other people were kind of on this idea that for a generation that had everything marketed to them, to connect them to something that wasn't just the latest fad. It wasn't the most popular idea, but when students got a hold of it, they really grabbed a hold of it. And I like to tell people, like, I'm interested in doing songs that are going to prepare my students for their encounter with death. I have a bigger goal. And I think in RUF, probably the fact that we have ordained pastors, it's an arm of the church. I think we're thinking more long-term maybe than a lot of ministries sometimes can just be about how do you fill the room. And it's a balance because you can't just do all these weird songs that nobody knows, you know, especially the beginning of the fall. But hopefully you kind of be able to talk about why you're doing what you're doing. Anybody that's been around RUF will know that's part of our DNA. We always want to talk about why we're doing what we're doing so you can help students move beyond being consumers and interacting just to, I like this song or I don't like this song. We really want to drive them and draw them deeper in how they think about these things.
Yeah. Hey, John and Joe, just respond to that in terms of your own experiences with students, what Kevin's talking about there.
Yeah, no, I mean, to Kevin's point, I absolutely just agree and echo everything that he's saying, that oftentimes, you know, specifically youth ministry, but then also as you get onto the college campus with RUF, we can sell students short. We can think this is going to be above their head, or this is going to need to be, you know, something they're just not interested in. But like Kevin said, I mean, the opposite is true, that these students, they do want to be challenged. They do want to be confronted with truth. And I mean, yeah, Kevin, as you said, to prepare them for suffering. Joe and I, we actually were talking the other day just about a John Piper quote, and I can't remember the exact title from an address that he gave to youth workers, but he talked about, you know, you can get students' hands up in the air in a minute with the right crescendo, but will they follow the Lord when they suffer? And he's not bashing music. Yes, later on in that talk, I know he talks about just the importance of music in the midst of that. But yeah, preparing them to suffer, and oftentimes just getting into just deeper truths is going to do that. So all that to say, just to echo everything you're saying, Kevin.
Yeah, the other thing I'll say too is that I think a lot of youth culture is wrapped around this idea that it has to be shallow or goofy in order to connect with him. But like John just said, and like Kevin was saying earlier, I do think youth and teenagers and college students, they do have a desire to go deeper and to wrap their minds around bigger truths. And so one of the things I've had to think about as a worship leader with middle school and high school students is that it's easy to fall into this trap of thinking you want to give the people what they want. But what we actually have the opportunity to do is to shape and form what they want and what they like, because these are very formative years for them. And so I actually see it as an opportunity to put really good, rich lyrics and music in front of them. And Kevin, honestly, you've been such a huge blessing for that, even with my own music ministry, because we dip into so many Indelible Grace songs and get to show that to the students. I look at it as an opportunity to actually shape and form them instead of just giving them what I think they want.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you guys. Yeah. Doing college ministry is interesting. Like when I have those, freshmen walk into our first meeting this fall, there's really almost no common denominator music. I mean, some of them grew up, their youth group sang Pippin, some of them sang Hillsong, but it's very hard to find any common denominator music. And so you're going to have to be teaching them new songs, which again is why I want to talk about why we're doing what we're doing. Hey, we're going to sing this hymn and here's why. My little kind of tagline, I'll say is, with Indelible Grace, I was looking for songs that were more honest about struggle and more explicit about the gospel. And if you look at a lot of the songs we've done, a lot of it was about that. And the other kind of thing I think explains what Indelible Grace is about is that worship is formative, like it or not. So I was meeting with students who were telling me, here I am at college and I don't have a youth pastor call me up every week now. It's a different world when you go off to college. And so many of them at Belmont had grown up in church, but they felt like, I don't feel Jesus like I did. One of my friends doing RUF said, every student I meet is trying to get back to a mountaintop experience they had at middle school camp. And, John Newton in his letters, where he talks about kind of the three stages of Christian growth, he says a growing Christian is somebody who kind of is known more by, feels more struggle. And God even sometimes removes the sense of his presence to draw us to a deeper level of trust. And these students are thinking that maybe they're not even Christians because they don't feel like Jesus, they don't feel Jesus the way they had. And I was like, man, we've got to find some better songs to sing, because as I pushed into that, I realized it wasn't the Bible that was shaping their sense of what the normal Christian life felt like. It was these songs they were singing. So I found a song like I Asked the Lord That I Might Grow. I don't know if you know that one, but it's by John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace. And I'll often say, do you think the guy who wrote Amazing Grace understands the gospel? Yeah. Well, consider this song, because this song suggests that God is not the divine pharmacist who just exists, for us to write the script and him to fill it, but he's the divine physician who might actually have a purpose in even bringing hard things into your life. And again, it's not like this explains all your struggle, but it's a testimony song that says, consider God might be doing something bigger, maybe even more confusing than you thought. And I think those kinds of things are just so helpful, because I find a lot of students that have been raised in church, they just have real kind of false expectation about what the normal Christian life feels like. College is often that time when they begin to wrestle with these things. And yet if they have a framework that's misinterpreting kind of what's going on, it can be really, I think, fatal for their Christian life.
Yeah, and Kevin, when you said something, it struck a thought of you're talking about college students coming to campus and what kind of genre or style of music you're going to use, and that, you know, truth is kind of the common denominator. I was thinking of Andrew Stanton, who's one of the creators of Pixar, and I believe he's a believer as well, and he talked about just how much they do in Pixar is really trying to tap into truth that they know is going to resonate among a broad audience. And so if you think of, you know, the success of Pixar and really what they're doing, and kind of some of what Andrew Stanton was saying in that quote, is their foundation is, okay, what is true, and kind of going with truth, but then trying to think of how to flesh out a story that's going to resonate. So again, just kind of to your point.
Yeah, it's true and beautiful. I believe I heard him speak at Belmont at Chapel one time, and he talked about the importance of good stories and beauty. And that's, again, some of the what the hymns offer is just really metaphors and a richness of metaphors that are missing in a lot of modern songs, that really open up parts of the Bible that people hadn't thought about. And so I love pointing that out. I mean, the beauty, the use of paradox, to be able to say things with just a few words that help kind of, they just help you kind of keep ruminating on something. I do think sometimes the modern songs to me feel like modernistic preaching. I don't mean liberal modernistic. I mean like evangelical, you know, you reduce this rich biblical narrative to kind of 3 points about how to have a better marriage. And I feel like a lot of the modern songs are that way too. I talk about it. See, it feels like you're singing other people's conclusions, but you haven't actually experienced the richness of the story yourself. And the hymns, often like the Psalms, will take you on a journey that I think is really helpful. And but again, it's helpful to point this out to the students too. I'm a big believer in the students want to know why you're doing what you're doing, and we want as many people as possible to know why we're doing what we're doing, so that they're going to be looking for churches that get these things, and they can be part of churches and part of influencing their churches to be thoughtful and reflective about why we're doing what we're doing. Why are we singing what we sing?
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, one of the issues that I get most concerned about in youth ministry is if you ask that question of a youth worker, and I've been guilty of this, you know, why are you doing what you're doing in terms of your strategy, whether that be worship, whether that be your speaking, whether that be curriculum, you know, whether it be games, whatever it is, why are you doing what you're doing? Nobody really knows how to answer that. I mean, very few people do, because most of them will answer by saying, well, so-and-so's doing it, and it seems to have worked over there. And I think the evangelical church is very guilty of that. And we've fallen into that, and this generation of youth workers has been nurtured into that, where that's normal. I want to just mention one more thing, because Kevin, you brought this up, that all worship is formative. Would it be fair to say that, you know, philosophically, I've never met a youth worker who says, you know, I want to take kids backwards in their faith. You know, typically we are striving to take kids deeper in their faith. Christian parents who are serious about the faith, same thing. Philosophically. Functionally, however, as we engage in worship and we engage students in worship, it's formative. Is it possible for it to be formative in a deformative way where we're taking them backwards and we're really not taking them deep? I mean, are you?
Oh,
you
know,
yeah. Talk about
that. Yeah, that's what I was talking about. That's what I realized was happening. It's been this way for a long time. I mean, so many of our preaching heroes were very engaged in music and in the songs that their people sang, whether it's Calvin, Luther, people like J.C. Ryle, Charles Spurgeon, George Whitfield. They all put together hymn books. But in my tradition, the Reformed tradition, often we just think that preaching is the main thing and that the songs we sing don't matter very much. I think because in RUF, we're not doing the sacraments, we're not doing kind of a full liturgical thing. We just basically have kind of a call to worship, a few songs, sermon, prayer, then everything's got to count. So that made me begin to think about, okay, what are the songs doing, and are they undermining what I'm trying to teach students in discipleship? When you actually start attending to the songs, are they basically songs that are like, Jesus, I just love you all the time, it's all I ever want to do, and thus you're beginning to shape students' understanding of what is normal. If you misname normal, you really mess people up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got a lot of students, I feel like normal has been misnamed for them. And it really becomes a really important issue to engage.
Yeah, I get worried a lot that we're just in much of our worship music chanting mantras. And I get to speak at a variety of different places and experience different worship styles, the full spectrum. And that's what that's one reason why I'm so passionate about this and having this discussion today, because it's almost like I want to say to youth workers, look, you've been consuming cheap, fatty hamburger for so long. Mm-hmm. You're feeding it to your kids. It's the best that you know. But let's pull back the curtain here. There's some filet out there. And my apologies to vegans who don't like red meat metaphors. But
we're up against, though, a whole marketing machine.
Yes.
Right? And even when we started, it wasn't as intense as it is now. I'm talking about the Christian music industry. Because when we put out the first record in 2000, there was still Christian music that wasn't just worship music. But now the industry, for the most part, the bread and butter is worship music. And so that's, we're up against it. Yeah. And youth pastors get marketed to a ton. I think it's hard to be countercultural because, again, if you try to go too far and you don't sing any songs that people know at all, then, the kids might leave and then you don't have the opportunity to kind of talk more about why you're doing what you're doing. Yeah. But I think, try and sneak in some of this stuff and talk about why you're doing what you're doing. And maybe some of the kids catch it and begin to talk about it. Because I do find the ones that grab a hold of it really becomes important to them. And I have now a harder time getting my worship leaders to include the modern songs. And I'm like, you got to include a modern song. But they don't want to.
Joe, you want to say one more thing and we're take a quick break.
Kevin, I was going to touch on the worship is formative statement you made, because I grew up in this kind of modern worship movement where it was all kind of about what you were feeling in the moment. And so that I think wrapped up in that was this idea that you shouldn't have to think too hard about what you're singing because you need to feel what you're singing. Yeah. And I have this distinct memory of being in the old traditional service at First Methodist Church in Tuscumbia, Alabama, where we were singing "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross," and something just hit me in that moment of realizing that I'm thinking harder than I normally do when I'm listening to other worship music, and something's happening. Like there's a story being driven into my heart right now. And I think just going back to what you were saying of realizing that worship is formative in that it actually teaches things to our hearts and shapes us and molds us in ways that actually helps us to grow and learn. And that's like thinking hard about something in worship is not a bad thing. It's actually a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to realize that.
But you talk about being malformed. I mean, the idea that spirituality and thinking are opposed to each other, that's deeply embedded in sort of more Pentecostal charismatic culture, which then influences a lot of our kind of modern evangelicalism. So that's a hard one. You've got to kind of hit that in lots of different ways. What is prayer? What is the point of all this stuff? It's not just thinking. I love Tim Keller. He has the line about, meditation is like thinking a truth in and then thinking out the implications. But for the most part, people think spirituality means divorcing your mind, or even people with the hymns, they'll say, well, there's too many words to really worship. And that's exposing some presuppositions about worship and what the point is.
Yeah, and some deficiencies, I'd say. I sound very judgmental, I know, but, I've been battling this for so long. And I got to tell you, we're going to take a break, but we're going to come back and talk. This conversation is getting me excited, and I hope that those of you who are listening, you'll stick with us and continue to listen. Get excited as well. So we'll be right back. Someone once told me that readers are leaders and leaders are readers. I'm convinced that one of the most important disciplines for youth workers and parents is reading. I've also found that reading and discussing books together has helped me not only stay on a reading schedule, but to consider things that I might not have noticed on my own. That said, I want to invite you to join a reading community where together we read noteworthy and provocative books on important matters related to faith and culture. Our CPYU Reading and Discussion Group can be found on Facebook. Almost 500 people are a part of the group, and we'd love to have you join us. We read and discuss one book every 2 months. Just search on Facebook for the CPYU Reading Discussion Group and then request to join. I'd love to have you join us. Well, welcome back, everybody, to Youth Culture Matters. We're having a conversation with Kevin Twitt from Indelible Grace about music and worship, and my friend Joe Deegan, my friend John Parent from RYM, Reformed Youth Ministries. They've joined us here. And I want to go back to you, Kevin. I got excited. You mentioned two books that I've read that I would love for youth workers and others to read. One is Gerard Kelly's Retro Future. I can't remember the last time somebody brought that book up, but I read that. It's probably been out for close to 20 years, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, at least.
And so that book there, and then Newton's Letters, which, you know, that goes along with the whole idea of the texts of some of the older hymns and the richness and the beauty. And I have found a treasure chest of inspiration and, you know, spurring on to my own growth in some of the older letters from some of the older pastors and the Puritans, and just finished the Select Letters of John Newton, which I think Banner of Truth published, but a great, 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 great resource. But when you mentioned Gerard Kelly, you mentioned that whole notion of roots and wings. Talk about that, because there's actually a documentary out that was put out a few years ago about what you're doing with Indelible Grace that I think is titled Roots and Wings. So unpack that for us.
Yes, right. So we like that phrase, don't we? Yeah. So it's the idea that we want students rooted in something bigger than just kind of what's going on with this generation. But we also want to give them wings. In other words, invite them to add their voice. And that's, you know, trying to find a way to kind of not just be about traditionalism, but also not just cutting off the tradition. And I think probably because RUF is an arm of the church, that we talk a lot about wanting to, we do RUF for the church to be shaped 20 years from now. You know, we're going to impact the future of the church by shaping the future leaders of the church. And so we always want to be rooted, but then we also want to invite students to add their own voice. I actually think, you know, it's easier with college ministry, honestly, than youth pastors, because I almost never get a call from a parent who's upset with something I said or did. If I'd been a worship leader at a church, I probably wouldn't have been able to do Indelible Grace music, because I would have had complaints from people, right? I mean, pastors get complaints, but worship leaders get even more intense complaints when you change a tune to a hymn, for instance. So college ministry is actually a great kind of sweet spot to try to innovate, not just for the sake of innovating, but really it was about how can I get my students to sing some of these rich texts. You mentioned Newton's Letters. You know, he talks about the importance of not living on our frames. He says immature Christians live on their frames, which is sort of an emotional state. And it's interesting how often we sing on Christ the Solid Rock, and that line, I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. And yet most people don't have any idea what they're even singing. Right? They don't know what a frame is, but a frame means I don't trust, even when I feel the love of Jesus, that's not what I trust in. Right? So I like to explain often one thing from one hymn during each worship service, and then hopefully the students, they're having their experience with that music enriched. So yeah, I love that idea of roots and wings. We want to connect students to the church's tradition, but then invite them to add their voice.
Yeah, and that what you just said about frames goes back to, I think, what Joe said just about emotions and some of what he was raised in, because that directly addresses, you know, the fact that we should mistrust our emotions. We shouldn't, you know, put too much stock in our emotions. Emotions are a great gift from God, but we put way too much stock in that. And I What troubles me is that we are actually living in a world right now where, especially with, I would say, with progressive Christianity and some of what we're seeing in the church, there mm-hmm. is more of a trusting in one's heart and stating such. I trust my heart. I go where my heart leads me, which is extremely frightening to me, you know, when I look inward at my own heart, rather than trusting in the truths of God's word. So I love that. I love that. And I want to go back to something that the guys were talking, well, you all talked about this, but I had written down a question, you know, do we expect too little of our students, especially middle school and high school? And I think that has been a we've had a slow march towards that becoming more and more embedded, that we think, we don't think highly enough of what our students can handle. And I just want to mention this because I actually have heated discussions with youth workers about this, that you can't expect too much of a student intellectually. We need to entertain. We need to. And I'm all about, you know, having fun in youth ministry as well. But we put, I think, too much stock in that. And the scale for me has tipped over the years. And one of the things that I've seen with RYM, and Joe and John have been behind this along with the other folks at RYM who run their summer conferences, you know, I'll go down, like I was just down with these guys this summer in Panama City Beach for one of their conferences, and I walk into the room in the evening, and you had, what, 1,500 kids at one of the conferences, John?
That's right.
And they're preaching to these students, and it's not entertainment. I mean, the students are having a good time, and the worship, Joe's leading lively worship, but they're taking these kids deep, and these kids are, they are, you know, they're like sponges. They're absorbing this, you know, all at different levels, I'm sure. But, you know, it just is testimony to the fact that we can, you know, go deeply with this.
Well, can I jump in on something
before
we move on? And Kevin, you might have already answered this, but talking about singing, you know, I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name, and how oftentimes we can sing that and not even know what we're singing. And I know, I'm sure we've all had friends who just have made statements like, oh, I don't really pay attention to the lyrics. I just like the beat, or I like the sound. And of course we can appreciate aesthetic beauty of an instrument, certain sound that an instrument makes, but how can we train people to focus on the lyrics, to think about what they're singing? I mean, this can be from, you know, the pulpit, as well as, you know, youth workers, but also parents, you know, teaching their children. But just some thoughts on how to teach people that.
I think the place you have to start is the idea that worship is formative, like it or not. It's just like, you know, with Calvinism, like total depravity. You got to start with that. If you don't, if you don't get that, it's hard to kind of get the rest of what that's about. If worship is formative, then you have to attend to what you're doing and the songs you're singing. So that to me is really where I would start. Colossians 3, you know, talks about the word dwelling in you richly, and it's a plural you. So it's talking about your community. We talk, you know, about the idea of being a gospel driven community. And the Apostle Paul says for that to happen, you need to sing. So I think we often think of singing, I think, especially in the Reformed tradition that I'm part of, as secondary. But the Apostle Paul doesn't see it that way. And I think that singing, you know, a couple reasons. One, it's an embodied experience. So it helps us remember that the gospel is not just a newfangled idea. It also is a communal experience. You hear others singing and they hear you, right? So it's an embodied communal experience. And Augustine said, he who sings prays twice, that singing intensifies whatever you're doing. So I think that's where you start. If worship is formative, then what does that mean? Then look at the songs, like Jamie Smith, you know, in his work, which I really appreciate, says, try to become like an alien sociologist, step into your youth ministry and just try to observe what's actually happening. The subtext, not just what you think is happening, but what is actually happening, what messages are actually being communicated, and then think about that and reflect upon that.
That's so good. We had Jamie Smith on, and we talked about some of these things. Yeah, and you know, what he's doing is just challenging us in so many ways to go deeper. So I'm thrilled that you mentioned that. Kevin, I want to switch gears here because you're working on a college campus with RUF, and one of the issues that we talk about here, and it's related to what you're saying about music and the way that we describe the Christian life, you know, what it is, and how we erroneously describe the Christian life, you know, happy, happy, happy all the time. And I was kind of raised in that as well and not prepared so much for suffering. But on the college campus right now, one of the things we realize is that in our healthcare centers on any college campus across this country, Christian or not, stress and anxiety are the two issues that are being treated the most. Would that be the case even at Belmont? You're seeing that in your students?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. So
I think self-reporting, half the students are medicated, so it's probably higher. And I definitely, you know, I've been doing RUF, I think this is year 25 for me at Belmont. So without a doubt, there's quite an increase in anxiety and stress compared to 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, I mean, again, go back to Bobo's in Paradise. David Brooks talks a lot about the meritocracy, that life is a continual aptitude test. You're kind of, you know, just one false step or one false statement, one bad tweet away from like ruining your life. Everything matters in this intense kind of way. That's a lot of pressure, but it's also one of the reasons why I said I wanted to find songs that were more honest about struggle, but also explicit about the gospel. And I find, you know, a lot of the songs aren't really that explicit about the gospel. I actually had an experience about 10 years ago, was part of a week-long seminar at Calvin College where we looked at the top 250 modern worship songs, according to CCLI, over the last 10, 20 years. And we also looked at the top 250 hymns and then kind of examined that with regard to moral therapeutic deism.
Christian Smith.
Now, it's pretty fascinating. You know, well, we couldn't say that the songs created it. They certainly didn't give you much to resist it. And I think, you know, it's so important for my students to know that the gospel secures the smile of God. I think that's so important. So we sing a song like, let us love and sing and wonder. Let us wonder, grace and justice join and point to mercy's store, the storehouse of mercy. When through grace in Christ our trust is, justice smiles and asks no more. And I think Marva Dawn's book, Reaching Out Without Dumbing Down, even though I don't like the chapter on music, I think is not very helpful at all, a musical style. The rest of the book's really helpful, again, in thinking about this idea of worship being formative. You know, she talks a lot about being able to be shaped and formed within our church or within our RUF meeting so that you can go out into the world and say, I don't believe your lies anymore. The idea is not, you know, you can't jury rig your heart to say, I don't need to be perfect, because God created you to bask in the approval of another. And you have to have students understand what it means to have the righteousness of Christ, not just forgiveness and a new opportunity to try to impress God. And I think so many students grow up with this half gospel that you've been forgiven as long as you know, do the right things or invite Jesus in your heart, whatever that paradigm is. But the idea that the imputed righteousness of Christ is yours and that the smile of God has been secured, I think is really helps with this perfectionism and this anxiety. And I really love the book of Hebrews and the idea about being welcomed in and not just being forgiven. You need Romans, Galatians, but you also need Hebrews, those two things together. And really my key verse that I tell people all the time, Isaiah, I think it's 54, 5, that your maker is your husband, right? The one who made you and said, this is what I made you for, is also the one who loves you passionately and married himself to you. And we tend to fall off on one side or the other of those two things, but trying to hold them together, that's what I'm looking for my students to get.
My sense of things has been that in our youth ministries, when we communicate through our teaching or our lack of teaching and our music, that the Christian life is all about you and your emotions and that Jesus will make you happy, we're actually creating fertile soil. We're putting our kids in fertile soil for anxiety and stress to take root and grow. And this is where I love what you're saying, Kevin, about preparing kids and students for life and the sufferings of life, which is really where God does his great work in us and where we communicate, you know, the truths of the gospel and preaching the gospel to ourselves. I'm wondering, Kevin, I'm going to put you on the spot here because One of the places for people to start with Indelible Grace music is to go back, and you can listen online. I know that you can get this through the Indelible Grace site, which we'll put a link to. But that recording you did at the sold-out Ryman Auditorium in 2010, I believe it was. And what was beautiful about that was not just the experience of listening to that music and being instructed by the richness of that music, but there were, I think, three or four of the tunes that you folks did. Kevin, you actually explained the occasion and what those rich hymns came out of. And one that really struck me, and when you talk about suffering and difficulty in life, this is where I'll put you on the spot, is you told the story of O Love That Will Not Let Me Go.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Is that something you can, off the top of your head here, share?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I actually do these kinds of things a lot. I don't sing, but I can play guitar and I can tell the stories. And actually, my son, who was in the womb, my oldest son, Cooper, was in the womb when we made the first Indelible Grace record. He's now just begun his sophomore year in college. So the last two summers, he and I have went and done hymn sings. We call it hymns and stories, where we'll sing and I'll tell the stories kind of in between every song. The O Love one is particularly helpful. And it's got that verse, O joy that seekest me through pain, not by doing an end run around pain. And George Matheson, who wrote that, was a Scottish preacher in training, I suppose. He was at seminary, engaged to a woman, began to lose his sight, and then eventually became blind. She left him, became a pastor anyway. He was called the Blind Bard of Edinburgh and pastored a pretty large church, a couple thousand people. The night that he wrote that hymn was the night of his sister's wedding. And she was the one who was taking care of managing his household. He stayed behind. The rest of the family went to the wedding. He said that he wrestled with God and something of incredible difficulty passed between them. And out of that experience, the hymn came. He wrote a couple hundred other hymns, none of them like O Love as far as the quality. And he said that one came to him almost like it was dictated in about 15 minutes. Mm. And what I always love to point out there is that idea of the bow, the rainbow. He talks about in that verse about joy. I think he originally actually wrote, I climb the rainbow through the rain. The hymnal editors changed it to I trace the rainbow through the rain. Climb the rainbow, it's basically the idea there in this Noah story. The bow is the picture. It's a battle bow, the Hebrew word for a battle bow, that's cocked and aimed at God himself. That's the promise that God gives, the sign of the promise that he won't destroy the earth by flood again. And then, of course, you know, what is the gospel? Paul says all the promises of God are yea and amen. That battle bow is loosed upon Christ. So when trials come, if you understand justification by faith, then you understand that the trial is not an expression of God, you know, he doesn't like me anymore, right? You don't have to worry about what he thinks about you. Instead, you can kind of wrestle with what is God doing in the midst of this. So, yeah, I love those hymns and hymn stories. There are definitely a lot of apocryphal hymn stories out there. Maybe in the next segment we can talk some about where to find some of those stories and resources.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. We've hit break time, and we'll be right back. Stick with us with this conversation about music. Tens of thousands of kids have been trained by their parents and youth workers to think Christianly about music and media with our How to Use Your Head to Guard Your Heart 3D Guide to Making Wise Media Choices. This easy-to-use teaching tool needs to be in your youth ministry toolbox if you desire to teach your students to integrate their faith into all of life. Jesus calls us to follow him, and that includes following him into the 6 to 9 hours a day of screen time that shape and mold the beliefs and behaviors of our kids. To learn more about our 3D Media Evaluation Guide and to order a copy for every member of your youth group, go to our website at cpyu.org. Teach your kids to engage with media to the glory of God. Well, before we jump into some of the practical suggestions, and we're going to pick Kevin's brain on that and Joe's brain as well, since they've been involved in doing that for years now. John, you had a question. You wanted to double back and ask a question about moralistic therapeutic deism that Kevin mentioned.
Yeah, that's right. And just kind of back on what you said with that, Kevin, and how sometimes our music can miss the gospel. And I was talking with Robert Rowe, which some of you may know, works with See Jesus. And that's a ministry Paul Miller started. And really just kind of the essence of that ministry was them realizing that we've kind of missed the person of Jesus, you know, in our theology, that there's, you know, rooms we can fill with books of justification, union with Christ, all of this, but kind of missing some of just the actual humanity and personhood of Jesus Christ. And so that just made me kind of struck a chord of a thought, no pun there. I realize that just came out. Do we have any theological holes or gaps in our songwriting that you've noticed? You may have already answered that in just kind of setting up that moralistic therapeutic deism. But as you kind of look at maybe even more recently, what are some, you know, theological holes that we may have in some of what we're singing?
In modern songs?
Sure. Yeah. Back even further.
Yeah. Well, so when I mentioned that study that I was part of at Calvin, I mean, one of the things that came out of studying those is how the word sin is never used as a verb in those top 250 modern worship songs. It's only a few times used as a noun, my sin, but there's never an experience of I have sinned, Lord, I have sinned, right? There's almost no Trinitarian content. Now, this is a few years ago, and some of these things have gotten better. I particularly think songs about suffering and struggle, there's been more of that. I think Crowder's done some stuff, Matt Redman's 10,000, you know, reasons. There's some notable examples, but there's still a lot more about God, you know, heal my shame rather than forgive my sin. That seems to play more into the moral therapeutic deistic conception. Lester Ruth, who's a research professor of worship at Duke, has done a lot of work on that corpus of modern worship songs and examining them for theological content or places where there's gaps. But I would say this, even in the old hymns, there's some gaps too, particularly social justice and the connection between the new heavens and the new earth. N.T. Wright points this out in his book, Surprised by Hope. Very few hymns that aren't like escapist when it comes to heaven. For All the Saints is a notable example of one that is pretty good. And I've definitely tried to find songs that speak of the hope of the new heavens and the new earth wherever I could, because I think that there's not a lot about that. I've looked for songs that are really explicit about justification, imputation of Christ's righteousness. I think that's missing from a lot of songs. Lester Ruth says the basic message of a lot of modern songs is that we invite or we basically bring God into our presence through singing, that music is actually the mediator of to connect us to God. And so that's a problem. But I think, you know, one issue that, again, I mentioned Hebrews and the idea of being welcomed in, that certainly is a biblical theme. So we don't want to miss that. And I particularly am wanting some more songs about the richness of the theme of adoption. And it's very hard, you know, there's almost no old hymns that talk about that. I keep telling my friend Keith Getty, you know, when are you going to write the hymn about adoption? Maybe Boswell and Papa and some of those guys, they I think they wrote one, but we could use some more about that, I think, because Paul in Galatians says that's kind of the apex, right? That, you know, he sent his son born of a woman so that we might become sons of God, and he sends the Spirit so we would feel like sons of God. And there's not a lot of songs that develop that. I'd love to see some new songs about that. And then also songs that connect the gospel to social justice.
I'm just going to give a shout out to Joe Deegan. He wrote a song called Child of the King.
Oh, there you go.
That gets onto the theme of adoption. So there I know he's not going to say that.
Good job, Joe. All right, I got to hear that one.
Well, here's what I want to do. I want to talk about, and this is where I'm going to really pick Kevin's brain and Joe's brain a little bit, just in terms of the kinds of things you've done as you've been thoughtful about this. Give us some advice on how youth workers can start incorporating hymns into their ministry, and, you know, what are some ways to teach our students the stories behind some of the hymns, because it's so rich. Kevin, why don't you start, and then we'll jump off to Joe and what he's done.
Well, you know, I would say not every hymn has a great story. So I think there's three things to look at to enrich people's use of the hymns. One is there might be a particular story. Sometimes there's things about the hymn writer's life and their background story, even if there's not a particular story about that particular hymn, that can be helpful. And then sometimes it's just pointing out a particular phrase or particular line. So I think if you broaden your what you're looking for beyond just a particular story, then you'll find there's more things you can draw on and point out. And so a couple things that are helpful. The best book, I think, for hymn stories, unfortunately, is out of print, but through the wonder of Google Book Search and Amazon Print on Demand, you can get it still, is Lewis Benson. His two books, Studies in Hymns, Series 1 and Series 2, are two completely different books. He's kind of the granddaddy of Presbyterian hymnologists. His hymnal collection is up at Princeton Seminary, and he's the true historian. I haven't used Robert Morgan's books as much. I know Keith Getty really liked them. They had them at the Sing conference here that I went to a couple weeks ago. He seems pretty thoughtful in what he's doing. I also really like a book by a lady named Faith Cook called Our Hymn Writers and Their Hymns. And that is a great book for giving you like one chapter on Isaac Watts, one chapter on Charles Wesley. So you don't have to read an entire biography on each of these people, but having some of that understanding of their background, sometimes you can make connections then between the particular hymns. And then I'll mention, I do have a few stories that I've stuck on the Indelible Grace hymn book website, which is kind of even more than the Indelible Grace website. The Indelible Grace hymn book site is kind of like a great place to find resources. And there's a librarian at Southern Seminary up in Louisville, Chris Fenner, F-E-N-N-E-R, and I can find you the link to his work with hymns, but he's been doing some really great research on different hymns and telling stories behind them, and he's just kind of getting going with that work, but all the stuff he's done is really, really great.
Joe.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to say, this is a super practical point, but to figure out how to start incorporating hymns into youth ministry, I'm just going to harp on what Kevin has done with Indelible Grace. Again, super practical point, but he's rewritten a lot of these old hymns to music that's very accessible and honestly easy to play on guitar. And I know that sounds like a really random thing to say, but if you've got this youth group, I was a youth pastor for 7 years, so I kind of know what it looks like to try to build a music team with your youth group. And the instrument I always tell youth pastors to start with is guitar, because A, it's more likely that you've got somebody in your group that is learning that or knows how to play it. And B, it's a pretty good all-encompassing instrument to have rhythm and music at this, the notes at the same time. And so I think one of the great things Indelible Grace does is it makes these songs really accessible and easy to play if you've just got one instrument, which may just be an acoustic guitar. And so being able to find music that has pretty simple chord structure like that, and Indelible Grace has just been a great resource for a group that might just have a really small music team that wants to put that together.
That's definitely been an intentionality on our part. Matter of fact, we made those first two Indelible Grace records, and I found a lot of like youth ministries and churches were trying to duplicate the sounds of the records. And I was like, you don't have the same musicians I have. You should try to get the basic tune and then incarnate it in your setting. But I always wanted each song that we put on a record, we try it out with just an acoustic guitar in a living room. And if it doesn't work, then we don't record it. And actually on the Indelible Grace hymn book, there's guitar vocal demos of every song. I kind of tell people I consider it my penance, because people were trying to do the full production. I was like, no, just strip it down to one guitar, one voice, and then you build it up in your setting. So we do think that. And I think part of it's because with RUF, a lot of times we're just going into like a classroom and having to set up whatever sound we have, whatever instruments we have. So the songs have to work stripped down. And I will say this too, that first thing we did was called the RUF hymn book, which we still have that in print. The online Indelible Grace hymn book is a lot more stuff now. That RUF hymn book had 133 I think, songs in it. Half of them were traditional tunes. We've never been about trying to deconstruct church music. If there were good serviceable tunes that we could play on an acoustic guitar, then that was great. But a lot of the songs that or hymn texts that we wanted to sing weren't in hymnals anymore. Like Arise, My Soul, Arise. That hadn't been in a hymnal for the Methodist hymnal for 100 years. It was actually still in the Presbyterian hymnal, which is where I found it. My friend Lester Ruth was like, where did you find that hymn text? So some of them, and like Dear Refuge, My Weary Soul by Ann Steele, very important hymn for kind of the Indelible Grace movement. That hadn't been sung for 100 years. And I found a lot of those songs in hymn books which didn't have any music in them. Because before the Civil War, hymn books didn't have tunes. The congregation might sing their whole hymn book with just a couple tunes. People often ask me, what was the original tune for Dear Refuge? And it's like, it's not really actually an appropriate question, because there weren't original tunes to most of the hymns you sing. There were a handful of tunes that would be mixed and matched. And so if we were going to sing a hymn like Dear Refuge, well, you can sing it to a tune. Like if you know a tune to Come Thou Fount, Rock of Ages, and Amazing Grace, you can sing 3/4 of your English hymns. But eventually, you know, maybe some students can write some new tunes. That's what I would do. I would just like Xerox off the words. We'd try it, might even sing it to a traditional tune. And I'd be like, man, if somebody wants to try a tune, we'll sing it next week. And that's one of the great things about youth ministry. You can do that. You can invite students in. I would give copies of Spurgeon's hymn book to my worship leading students. Sometimes they just find a text they resonate with and write a new tune. Even if the tune wasn't good enough for us to do more than once or twice, I knew that they were going to have to really get inside that text to write it to a tune. And that was going to be good for their spiritual well-being. So I'm a big fan of giving resources to students rather than just criticizing their songs. Resource them with things that they might grab a hold of. It's a better way to do it.
Amazing Grace. I'm just thinking about that. You're talking about original tunes. I remember that was actually first sung to the Coca-Cola jingle from the 1970s.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Kevin, you're not as old as me.
I remember singing Peaceful, Easy Feeling.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I remember, you know, that whole I'd like to teach. I don't want to sing, but, you know, and we would sing Amazing Grace to that as somehow that redeemed our singing of an old hymn. But the things we used to do in the 70s, you know, when I was in youth group, that our youth pastor used to do.
Jill, and a lot of people, you know, I should correct this thing. A lot of people talk about Luther, you know, writing his hymn text to drinking songs.
Yeah.
Don't say that, because it's actually not true.
Okay.
He did write what are called bar tunes, but bar in that context refers to a German term that refers to a musical form that's AAB. As a matter of fact, you can go on Wikipedia and hear the original syncopated tune for A Mighty Fortress, and you realize it's not a drinking tune at all. There's no way you could drink and try to sing this tune. You'd be tripping all over yourself.
So that's a part.
That's a later thing. Salvation Army did that. 19th century, there's some folks that do that. Now, the point, though, I think that people try to make when they use that idea that Luther used drinking songs is that popular music and worship music can go hand in hand. There is definitely a long history of that. And the reason you could sing Amazing Grace to some of those other kind of more popular folk tunes is because all of those English ballads and hymns have a root in Ambrose. Ambrose of Milan, who was the preacher that Augustine was listening to, when he wrote his hymns to combat Arianism, he didn't put them in a classical Latin poetic meter, put them in a popular meter, which then becomes the meter of most English ballads and then hymns. So that's why you can mix and match them. So I do think hymn music, worship music, should be folk music in the sense that music that can be sung by folks. And somewhere along the line, hymn tunes became associated with kind of upper middle class musical style, even though people like Watts and Wesley, William Cooper, deliberately toned down their poetry to the level of the uneducated so that it would be more popular in tone. Somehow songs that were written for the level of the poor and the uneducated have now been associated with kind of upper middle class musical style, which is unfortunate. So some people have criticized us for more popular musical styles. And some of that, I think, results from not understanding the history of church music as well. Mm. And I'll just give a plug, one more resource. My course on history of hymnody is available at Covenant Seminary's website. You can listen to it for free.
Wow.
I've been now teaching hymnology as an adjunct at Belmont and at Covenant Seminary for years now, just kind of self-taught, just reading lots of books, trying to figure out why people were resonating with these hymns, what was worship really about, hymn stories, trying to find old texts that I wouldn't get angry emails because I'd retuned somebody's favorite hymn. All that just sort of eventually I realized I knew a lot about hymns and should share it with people. So that might be another resource people would enjoy.
Hey, thanks for being a good steward of that. Joe, tell us about, you've got a resource you've created that can be helpful to youth workers.
Well, yeah, one of the things we're trying to do at RYM is create music that that can be singable and used in youth ministries and churches. And so we're recording albums that will have some original stuff that I've written, but also old hymns and new arrangements and even some Indelible Grace stuff. And along with that, I've written a Bible study. So for instance, our last album had 12 songs. So it's a 12-week Bible study where each week you're walking through the song and the scripture behind it and the stories and kind of breaking down the lyrics. And again, going back to what we were saying earlier, forcing you to think about what you're singing and inviting students to really talk about it and discuss it in ways that could help them grow and learn the music better. So that Bible study is for free on our website at rym.org. And it's a PDF that's available for download. Mm.
So, awesome. Yeah, how can we access that, Joe? Give us a website or give us a place to go find that.
John, yeah. Is our resource director. You can point us to that.
Yeah, if you get rym.org, there's a resource tab. And under that tab, you'll see Bible studies. So Joe's album, as he said, is entitled Promised Land, but we have three other studies that are free downloads. There's one on doctrine of scripture, one on prayer, one on justification that Trey Owens wrote, and we've got two others. We hope Church 101 will be coming out soon, and then Bible 201. So we're continuing to try to build these up and to have free Bible studies. We want to serve the local church in any way we can, and this is one way we hope to do that. I mean, Joe's working on a second album to release, and as soon as that album comes out, Lord willing, in January, he'll have another study accompanying that as well. So, yeah, we hope to just build up a library that can be helpful to youth workers, to churches.
Good, thanks. And Kevin, just mention all the different, you've mentioned a variety of things, but just summarize again how we can access you. I know that YouTube, if we go on there and we put Indelible Grace or even your name, all sorts of things come up that are very helpful, and that way folks can listen to some of your teaching as well as the music. But give us websites. You mentioned a few there.
Okay. Yeah, a couple things. Well, the history of hymnology or history of hymnody course, you can listen to that for free at covenantseminary.edu.
Put a link to that.
My podcast, which I believe is RUF at Belmont. There's a lot of episodes there talking about worship and hymnology, that sort of stuff. The Indelible Grace Hymn Book website, you can just Google that, Indelible Grace Hymn Book. Lots of great resources on there. We have all kinds of things that you can download, whether it's full piano music, you need to have the full piano music rather than just chord charts or lead sheets, simple guitar vocal demos, all kinds of stuff there. I've hopefully one day we'll be able to kind of create a similar thing, a Bible study around some of the hymn writers. I have about five or six of them that I've done, but maybe one day I can finish that. It's one of my goals, one of my dreams. For sure. I don't know if you put my last name on YouTube, who knows what comes up. but I think the documentary film is called Roots and Wings. So if you do Indelible Grace and Roots and Wings, that was really fascinating. You know, we did the Ryman. The reason we were able to sell it to Ryman, honestly, is because the Presbyterian Church in America, our General Assembly, our national meeting, was happening at the Nashville Convention Center, which is literally across the street from the Ryman Auditorium. Right. And so we had kind of a built-in, at least some people that were going to be in town. And we did that him sing. It was the 10th anniversary of the first CD coming out. So it was an opportunity to reflect on what the Lord had done 10 years later. And I actually couldn't find anybody to open up the show for us and only do a couple songs. And we needed to start on time. Anyway, there's a long story behind that. So we did like a little 15-minute documentary. And so many people said that that framed the evening because it was talked about why we've been doing what we're doing, where Indelible Grace came from. And so then after the concert turned out well and we had a soundtrack because we had recorded it and we're going to release this live record, well, then we're like, well, if we can get people to help us through Kickstarter, we could make a film, a documentary, and kind of expand more of the story of where this came from and why it mattered. Yeah. So I think for a lot of youth pastors or even like a worship team to watch that documentary together, I think it's about 80 minutes, and be able to discuss it, that can be a really good way to expose people to the vision of this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this is so good. I really.
Oh, I'll say one more thing, thing too. Actually, the Indelible Grace Instagram, I post stories regularly where I'll take an old hymnal from my collection and we'll kind of tell stories about that and talk about that. So there's a lot of good stuff there too if people want to follow the Instagram.
Just out of curiosity, I love tapping into people's interest in collections. How many hymnals in your collection?
Got thousands.
Wow.
Thousands. Yeah, and some really cool ones. Because I started doing this before you guys. It is much harder to find old hymnals. When I started out, I could find old leather-bound Presbyterian hymnals for $20 on eBay. Now they're like $75 or $100. But also, I've got all the common ones. So now if I find any ones that I don't have, I have to pay more money for them. But Google Book Search is amazing because almost all of those books you can get as a free PDF. But I love it, man. When I hear stories about college students looking on eBay or in bookstores for old hymnals, like that just throws me. Even though now I'm competing and having to pay more for the hymnals that I add to my collection, I'm happy to have people competing with me for that.
Yeah. You know, you've just given me an idea here because Chris and I live here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is the auction capital of the world.
Is it?
And okay. I'm telling you, I mean, we'll have,
is it?
You go on Auction Zip, there's probably 10, 15, 20 auctions today, 10, 15, 20 auctions tomorrow. And for me, that's sort of a release when I have a day off. I can just go and watch people and, you know, see what's happening. And I'll often see old German Mennonite Amish hymnals.
Yeah, German, yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to look for something for you. I'm going to try to find something you don't have.
And all right. Yeah, I don't have many German ones because I don't speak German. If there was any language I wish I knew, it was German.
Yeah.
Because there are probably 100,000 German hymns.
Yeah.
And they're some of the richest ones on suffering, especially the ones from the 30-year war period.
Yeah.
Some of the greatest hymns on suffering. And also, for a songwriter, they have a lot of unusual meters. And when you're trying, Joe will probably relate to this, when you're trying to put another tune to a common meter or long meter hymn text, it's really hard to find a fresh musical approach. But some of those German hymns translated into English have really unusual meters that can inspire a songwriter and a musician. So, yeah, a big fan of German. I just wish I could read it.
I'm going to keep my eyes open. That's good.
Thank you.
Hey, guys, I love this. I love this conversation. Yeah, John, you wanted to throw something.
I'm sorry. I don't know if this is the hardest question you get, Kevin, or the easiest. Favorite hymn? Do you have one favorite hymn you can share?
Yeah.
Probably Dear Refuge in My Weary Soul, because I love to share with people the story about Ann Steele, the first hymn writer to write Real Laments, the most important, female hymn writer. And that hymn, just even when I remember seeing that line browsing through an old hymnal, I was just like, whoa, you could say that in church? It just opened up so much. And I think people have resonated. It's not the easiest one to sing. So I think you have to give a rationale for why we're going to sing this song. That's not the easiest to sing. But that text, the way she takes you through this journey, it's very much like Psalm 73, where she kind of makes this bold orthodox statement and then kind of seems to fall into, do I really believe this is true? And comes back to a place of trust, but it's sobered trust. That does a lot of things that I love, but I also think Let Us Love and Sing in Wonder is one of the greatest hymns in the English language. So probably those two.
Great. Good question. Good question. So mm-hmm. we'll end with this. You know, I have these conversations with youth workers all the time, and I'll leave this guy unnamed. He's a great friend. He'll know if he's listening. I'm talking about him. But I've got this guy who's been a friend for years. He's been a youth worker, and I have pushed on him because in his tradition, it's kind of like what Joe talked about early on in his own life, it, just worship songs, you know, and worship songs, which are almost like chanting mantras. You know, I worship you, yeah. I worship you, we're here to worship yeah. you. And, well, let's get the worship going. Let's get some teaching going. And so I had a conversation with him where I was naming hymns. He knew none of them. He had never heard of any of them. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah. you have to listen to these things. And he just sort of laughed at me. And we have a great relationship. Well, he and his family came to visit us. We're that close at Thanksgiving one year, and it was beautiful weather, and he and I went out for a bike ride on a trail, and we were about 2 miles into the ride. I can still remember where we were, and he said to me, hey, I need to tell you something. I said, what's that? I almost fell off my bike when he said this. He said, I've been listening to some of those old hymns you recommended. Those things are awesome. And it was like this great revelation to this guy who'd been in ministry for 10, 15 years. And I right. just thought, oh, if all of us would just discover that. It's like that movement from fatty ground beef, you know, to the best filet in the world. And, you know, so I want to encourage youth workers to step out of where you are and tap into some of these resources we've mentioned today and the teaching we've heard today. And take your students there as well. You're doing them a favor and nurturing them. So, Kevin, thank you. Mm-hmm. John, Joe, thank you. And for those of you who joined us, thanks for joining us. And we'll chat with you the next time on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.